Test Case, Darwin and Intelligent Design, was presented by Charlie Dewberry on August 11, 2006, at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Faith and Science. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Okay. Hopefully, what I'm going to use this as is sort of a platform to try to pull a lot of the themes together of the week. So I'm viewing this more like a try to pull it together as opposed to just talk about what the heck's Polanyi talking about in that paper and why did we read that. But I am going to talk about that. So where I'd like to start is first, the first point I want to make is the whole debate about what's knowledge, what's opinion. That's probably as old as man. And so one of the things I want to highlight is in the Dover decision, they basically said this question, in other words, what constitutes science? And science constitutes the primary way we know, the authoritative way we know in this culture. That's been set for 500 years. Well, my first point is this is a debate that's been around forever. And my first point is we've talked about some of the major shifts in science. I mean, even during my lifetime, and I'm getting old, but I'm not 500 years old. I mean, there's been major shifts in our understanding of what constitutes science, even in the last 30 or 40 years. So anyone who would claim that our understanding of science, and by that they mean the methodological naturalism, defining science as a method of doing the scientific method, and that's the way it's been for 500 years, I think it's just a fallacious argument. I mean, that's not true at all. So, for example, we saw the case in the Copernican Revolution that we talked about on Wednesday, where the point was made that if you're going to make sense experience your ultimate authority, then Ptolemy wins. That if, in fact, you're going to argue that within our reason, that's what we're ultimately going to appeal to, then I think we have a problem, some major problems. So, but I'm not saying that sense experience isn't important. It surely is. I forgot to bring my text with me, but one of the places like 1 John, why does 1 John start out with, but I'm the guy that see. I'm the guy that was with Jesus. We saw him. We touched him. We did all of this. We looked at the resurrection accounts. Same sort of things. The eyewitnesses are appealing to their experience and to what they, you know, what they've gotten through sense experience. So I'm not denying sense experience. It's very important. But what I'm denying is, that's okay, yeah. What I'm denying is the claim that that's our highest authority. So, for example, it seems to me, as we, you know, I presented the example, we all go to the top of Spencer Butte, what would we see at sunrise tomorrow? We'd all see the sun rise. But yet we're going to argue that the Copernicans are right, that's not really what's going on. We'll argue that's right because our intellect is a higher authority than our sense experience. And what comes along with this is then a view that our intellectual picture, our worldview, our framework is incredibly important in determining what we see and how we understand even our experience. So in that case, we're using our intellect and saying that we've come to the conclusion that Copernican theory is true, And that basically sets a context then to understand what we see when we look on, when we look from the mountain at that sunrise. I mean, it looks like, but we recognize that our sensory experience is relative, that it depends on the worldview or the theory that we're going to see it. Thomas Kuhn called this theory-ladenness of all data. So the point is that the old claim put together by the empiricists and that in philosophy of science it came largely from the logical positivists, that in philosophy of science what got said was essentially that there are these objective facts that are the building blocks of science. That's what constitutes science and its progress. Well, I'm basically saying there's no such thing as an objective fact in that whole view that we talked about on Wednesday. It's just flat out wrong. It's not defensible at all. So I'd like to just highlight then, okay, what is our epistemology then? And we've talked about this kind of off and on all week. First, it's not skeptical. And by that, you know, we talked about that new kind of doubt that basically got raised in modern philosophy. What I'm basically saying, the response, we shouldn't really respond to the skeptic at all. The only response we should basically have for them is they're not taking it seriously. I mean, they all know they're knowers. To basically say, I'm not a knower, well, prove that. Well, their life proves it. They can't not essentially be a knower. They live their life believing they know stuff. So it's not a real question. Secondly, what we've been talking about is, in philosophical terms, called common sense. It came from the Scottish philosopher, largely Thomas Reid. It's called common sense philosophy. Very important in the history of ideas, and yet in philosophy, the only place Jack and I were able to do Thomas Reid was an independent reading. And I can't remember how many of the department actually knew who he was. I'm not, you know. So, but even in a philosophy department, a number of them didn't really know who he was or what he was talking about. I think he's one of the most important philosophers to read. The third point I'd like to make that we've been talking about is the role of theory or worldview or paradigm, terms like that, where it's not just the facts that we're talking about, but it's our explanatory system as a whole that we use all the time as a filter to interpret. So the radical empiricists tried to say this stuff comes in and what it hits is a neutral or a blank slate. It just comes in, it's done to us. What we're saying is our mind is active. It sees and interprets this sense perception through the grid, more or less, of all our previous beliefs. And we have been talking about how it largely does this tacitly. So here's the Michael Polanyi sorts of arguments, that most of this, we're not really aware of it. We're out here experiencing and knowing objects in the world. We're not focused on the mechanism, the closer portions of that. He made the distinction between focal awareness and subsidiary awareness. Okay, so those are kind of some common themes that we've talked about as far as epistemology goes. Okay, so what are the implications here for the science-faith split? First, I don't think the split is at all defensible. There really is no split between science and all the other stuff. So we saw that basically the sciences that was given, the scientific perspective that was given in the Judge Jones position, or the Judge Jones ruling, was basically that science is this more certain, objective kind of form of knowledge that's different. I mean, it was really an implication of the argument they were making. We're arguing that really isn't true at all. Secondly, reason is a much richer concept than how reason was understood by most of the philosophers that we looked at. So reason as it's come to us has this mechanical sort of mechanism that's within us. That's a very limited picture of human reason. We're talking about including things like intuitions. Okay, so, and then reason isn't grounded only in sensory experience. All right. I'd like to shift for just a minute then, and I want to make a distinction that's going to be important for us. And the distinction I want to make is between kinds and variations. And I mean this in general, but we're going to talk about specifically about this in terms of biology in just a minute. And I think this is one of the places where Aristotle did pretty well. What Aristotle means by a kind is a class where all members of the class share the same features. And in Aristotle's view, the kind of classes I want to talk about are classes that are really qualitatively different from each other. Okay, and I'll explain what I mean by that. Let's say I'm a geologist, and I want to determine how hard a rock is. So I'm going to pick six or eight or nine different kinds of things that vary in hardness. So I might have something really, really soft, like a talc or something, or chalk. And so the issue is, will chalk scratch my rock? And then I might have something like a lead pencil. It's a little harder, but we're going up the scale. So, but I have these nine different things I'm going to test it with. Well, what we're saying here with regard to class is I do my scratches. It doesn't scratch till it hits five. If I do another one, I say that, oh, these both have the same hardness of five. They're in the same class. Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Now, what I want to highlight here is all of these, we know they're in the same class and that they share the same feature of having the same response to these of these different sort of tests or things that are going to determine which class it is. But now, with regard to these five things, how do I know how much space is between them? I mean, is chalk really close in hardness to the next thing? Is the gap here big or small? I don't know anything about that. There's just a gap there, okay? But what I do know is if I do the next one, and it's down here, I know this one's a four. It's not as hard as a five, but I don't know what the gap is in between. I have no information. All I know is these are discrete categories where there's gaps between them, and something is either in one class or another. Now, what would the other view be? The other view that I'm interested says, well, there's really no gaps, and this is the one we're most familiar with. There's just a continuum here, and there's always room to put something in between. This is just continuous. So what classes are in this case, they're just arbitrary breaks that we make for our convenience, but there's no gaps. You know, it's just we have this pure continuum across. So is that distinction clear? Are questions about that? Because if you don't follow this, we're going to get lost when I go to biology. Yeah.
You mentioned that beneath one, the category one, there could be a half, a three-quarters.
Well, yeah, but within a one, within a category one, now, when Aristotle did numbers, now he put fractions in here. We can have a one and a quarter, one and a half, one and three quarters. These differ by degree. In other words, 1.5 differs by degree, but it's still a 1, but there's difference. Okay, I'll give you a biological example now. Okay, what Aristotle is saying is we might have two classes, like ducks and geese. What Aristotle is saying is ducks and geese are different things. Ducks and geese have different essential features. These are classes, according to Aristotle. And under this, we might have wood ducks, mallards. These wood ducks and mallards and harlequin ducks, all the different kind of ducks, they just differ from degree between each other. But a duck differs in kind from a goose. Okay? So that's where we want to go here. This distinction will become important in just a minute. So, okay, does that answer your question, Dave?
Thank you. Yes.
Okay. All right. The reason I want to do this is one of the most fundamentally important questions in biology. How are we going to classify, and what are our classes? Now I want to go to Darwin's theory, because I'll just start out by saying is, look, if Darwin's theory is as true as people say it is, then intelligent design can't possibly be true. So if, in fact, Darwin's theory is true, then it seems to me intelligent design is false because it's saying something else. So the first thing that I'd like to address is, well, I'd like to look at Darwin's theory for a minute and just say, is it as true as people want us to believe it is? And for me, sitting down and actually coming to grips with Darwin's theory was something I finally did about 30 years ago. So before I was a Christian, I sat down and looked at Darwin's theory. And I ran into a problem with Darwin's theory. And the problem I ran into, I've given you a figure, this one. Now, I was hoping to give you a clean one that illustrates my point well. This was a first mock-up of it, and I didn't get the final. So I'm going to ask you to sort of make a couple corrections here in a minute. But basically, what Darwin's view is you start with an individual species at the bottom. So Darwin's view is A. So, and in fact, what's interesting about Darwin's book is, what is Darwin saying about species? What's the origin of a species? Well, it comes from a pre-existing species, okay? So right off the bat, I want to highlight something here. Darwin's theory is not about the origin of life at all. In fact, Darwin says, well, you can start with 1 or 5 individuals or so. So what Darwin is saying, he's making the same move that Charles Lyell made in geology. And he's saying, we have a starting point, and from that starting point, we're going to... Sorry, Peter. From that starting point, we're essentially now going to look at natural processes working at normal rates we're used to, and we may be out here somewhere. We'll go back to some point, and we can run this forward in the future in some situations. But there is a point upon which we say, this is the boundary, we go no farther, this is not a scientific question. So, for Darwin, he says, you start with 1 to 5 organisms. He doesn't specify what they are at all. So the first point is Darwin's theory is not about an origin of life at all. It's about starting from a particular point and then moving it. Now, what's his argument? And for the sake of argument, I'm going to accept all of Darwin's major points. Some of them are controversial a bit, but I'm going to accept them all. That is, variation can occur in that organism caused by the environment, mutation, or anything else. I'll accept all of that. Natural selection operates on those offspring, and there's differential survival of their offspring. And as a result, then, species A down here changes into species B. Okay, that's Darwin's argument. What do his opponents say? His opponents are really all biologists up until that time, Christian or non-Christian. What do they say? A species is an independent creation of God. It's a kind. So what Darwin has just shown is that a kind is not qualitatively different from another kind. He's shown that species are in fact not kinds. They just differ by degree from the one species he started with to the one species he just got. I think Darwin's right, and I'll accept that. That does occur in biology. I see it. I mean, I can list thousands of species that that's the case for. I'll grant him all of that. Now, Darwin now makes the claim that, okay, it might have taken 10,000 generations to get from one species to develop now into these two species. Then in his book, he says, and now instead of 1,000 generations or 10,000, now if we go to 1,000,000 generations, what we get is the rest of this figure. That we just extrapolate that process we've seen operating at the level of species, we're going to extrapolate it, you know, 1,000,000 times if we need to, but or up to 1,000,000 generations. And he says if you do that, we're going to get his picture here, that now this one organism can differentiate into all of what we call classes. Well, what's his point? All of this classification scheme along here is just a continuum. He calls it kind of like a bush. It's this big bush with limbs on it. And what natural selection does is come in and drive a wedge in it. And so it looks like there's real fish that are classes, that are distinct. And it looks like there's amphibians, you know, that are different with a major gap between them. But those aren't real. So let me just highlight a couple things here. One is Darwin's looking at it and he says, well, it looks like there's real kinds. And if there's real kinds, in a minute we'll see, well, if there's real kinds that are qualitatively different, that have a different essential features, you can't get there by Darwin's mechanism. So what Darwin is saying, those aren't real kinds. They don't have real qualitative difference. They only differ by degree. But it looks like they're difference of kinds. It looks like there's a gap between them, but it's not real. I mean, it's not a real one. Natural selection has made this apparent kinds. That's his argument. And for a lot of people, that's a very compelling argument. I want to take just a moment and read Mark Twain's response to this argument because I think it's really insightful. No one nailed it any better than this. In the space of 176 years, the lower Mississippi River has shortened itself 242 miles. Remember, Twain knows that because he's a riverboat captain. Okay? That's an average over a trifle over a mile and a third every year. Therefore, every calm person who's not blind or idiotic that can see back in the old Silurian period just 1,000,000 years ago next November, the lower Mississippi was upward of 1,300,000 miles long and stuck out over the Gulf of Mexico like a fishing rod. And by the same token, any sane person can see that 742 years from now, the lower Mississippi will be only 1.75 miles long, and Cairo, Illinois, and New Orleans will have joined their streets together, plodding along comfortably under a same mayor and mutual alderman. There's something fascinating about science. One gets such wholesale returns of conjecture out of a trifling investment of fact. Okay, but his point is here, he made an extrapolation. What grounds did Darwin have for making that same extrapolation? What argument did he give for making the extrapolation? He gives none. Now, how can this get missed? Why wouldn't people see this? How could that possibly happen? And I think the reason for it is this. One, Darwin would say, well, look, I'm just doing the same thing Charles Lyell did. Okay, well, you just passed the buck to Lyell. Why was Lyell doing that? So you go read Lyell. Lyell doesn't tell us either. So nobody going this route using this uniformitarian principle has ever spelled out really where the limits are or given a justification for what is a warranted extrapolation and what's not a warranted extrapolation. Darwin says, I'm just doing the same thing in biology that Lyell's doing in geology. And what's interesting, anybody here in geology? What would a geologist say now with regard to this kind of thing? So you go to the Oregon coast and say, what's the dominant process forming the coast of Oregon? One guy comes back and says, the biology. Next person comes back and says, wave action and tide. Third person comes back and says, plate tectonics. Well, all three of those people could be right. Yeah, it's litter, that's it. But the point is how's this happening? Because, see, in geology, they understand that when you look at a particular space and time scale, you got to pay attention to what makes sense. I mean, if you're out here looking at a square meter of the beach for 2 years, you don't want to be looking at plate tectonics because you're going to see nothing. You're not going to see anything happening. But if you go out there and ask, what's the biology doing in a square meter from 1 year to the next? That's a dominant process forming those features within that space and time scale. So geology now recognizes that when you look at processes, you need to look at what time and space scale is appropriate for them. And something that works at one time and space scale, like the biology, may not be relevant for looking at what's going on in a landscape over 1,000 miles and 10,000 years. So the point here is geology's already made the shift away from uniformitarianism. Biology hasn't touched it. Anyway, there's a couple other reasons, but I don't have time, unfortunately, to go into those right now. So what I want to point out is if I grant Darwin all he wants to grant me, what he's proven to me is species A over time will evolve into species B. Okay, I don't think anybody anywhere would get excited over that. I mean, there aren't that many people that care about biology. I mean, that's not what this is about. That's not what anybody cares about. People don't really care about biology much. I've learned that. But, you know, I mean, that's why nobody's that's not the interest we take. It's the implications now of what comes out of this model. Okay, so for me at least, I have a major problem with Darwin's theory. He's part right. His opponents had argued species were independent creations of God. They are kinds. They were wrong. Darwin was right about that. And he said that's what he set out to refute, is an opponent who believed that. He's right about that. But is the theory, the rest of it that he put together, right? And I'm arguing it's not. So if it's not right, now the question, well, let's assume for a minute that it is right. Well, if it's right, then any opposing theory that would come along ought not to be accepted. But at least when an opposing theory comes along, you ought to look at the merits of it. But if you have no reason to doubt the theory you currently hold is true, it's unlikely you're really going to take it very seriously. But if a theory has problems or somebody comes along with another theory that answers a lot more stuff, you might take a look at that theory. But if you really, like I say, if you really believe a theory is true, then it's unlikely that you're going to be open to much persuasion about another theory. So it looks to me, as I look at the debate that's gone on for a large period of time, well, and I'm using the term debate, I'm giving it more credence than I may. I wouldn't call it a debate at all. There hasn't been any intelligent discussion about the issue of origins, as I can see, in the last 20 or 30 years, probably, where the amount of intelligent discussion about that is really minuscule. Because I have to wonder if either side is interested in the truth or just winning the argument. The second point I want to make is, now why did I give you a B here? And the B, well, now the B's got a couple problems that I'll explain. First, I want to trade around the bottom. See how it says species, genus, family, order, class? Turn that upside down, just like the top one. It's supposed to run the same way. Okay? And the other point is, well, I'll make this point and then point out the other part, is B is Aristotle's. And so what Aristotle would say is, look, if we've got the five organisms Darwin said we could start with, and let's just say let's just say what we picked is a fish, an amphibian, a reptile, a bird, and a mammal. What Aristotle would say is, well, over time, we might expect that different kinds of different differences of degree will develop that we're now going to call them trout, bass, pike. Okay, that's perfectly acceptable under Aristotle's scheme. So the point I want to make is here is for Aristotle, he's claiming that these classes up here are real kinds. He might claim they're real kinds. Now, what would be true? What would be the difference in this figure between Darwin and Aristotle under these situations? Darwin would claim that a fish could, in fact, differentiate enough over time to actually become an amphibian. Aristotle would be saying, you can't do that. There's a gap between them. Now, what I would say is, okay, there they say something different. Let's go look at some evidence that would actually differentiate this problem. And virtually every piece of evidence, you know, in the last 6 months, we've seen hundreds of cases where the evolutionists claim, yep, see? And what are they all? They're down here saying, see, species A evolved into species B. Or, well, we're close up here. We got a little closer to this fish becoming an amphibian. We may have found something closer to the critical link here between the two. But the point is both of these explanations can account for virtually all of that stuff the same way. They both can equally explain every one of those instances. So what we have here, I would argue, is we're at the same place in biology that astronomy was with Ptolemy and Copernicus. These are roughly pretty close to equal empirical theories. They equally can explain the data. It seems to me that's where we are in biology. 99% of everything people say can be explained by either camp perfectly well. So at this point, that's what it looks like to me. But I'm not hearing anybody start looking at that's where biology is. Okay. So that's all I'll say about Darwin at this point. So, but what I want to say is, at least for me, Darwin's theory may be right. And if it's right, it seems to me there's a way I can make that understandable within my current model, my current worldview. It's not impossible, at least at this point, that I could sort of make sense out of that. Okay, so now let's shift gears and go to intelligent design. Well, what is intelligent design saying? Well, first it's pointing to design, that the world looks like it was designed. Well, that's not a new claim, actually. I mean, everyone sort of thinks it looks like it was designed. That's been the view from Aristotle on. And even Darwin, his point was not that it didn't look designed, but that it looked designed, but he could explain why it looked designed. So it seems kind of strange that people would have a real aversion immediately to all of a sudden saying, well, who's thought otherwise? I mean, even Darwin thought that. So who is it that actually doesn't think it's designed? So I don't want to say a lot about the details of intelligent design here at this point, but I mean, that's the first point, is the issue of whether or not it looks designed or not. I don't know anybody who really, over history, has denied that. So, but what is intelligent design saying or doing that has created a stir? I think ultimately it's this, that this really doesn't have much to do with biology, and the issues involved really aren't biological. So when someone like Michael Behe comes along and says, well, look, it looks to me like there's these irreducible, complex structures within cells that can't be explained by our current paradigm, therefore we ought to think maybe an intelligent agent did this, because I don't see how you get there by chance. Okay, that's raising a lot of issues, but they're really not primarily scientific. Their root philosophical. Now let's look for a minute at what happened here. Let's look for a minute how now, as a culture, how the culture at large is interacting with intelligent design. The first point I want to highlight is the most important question that everybody thinks is intelligent design science? That's the most interesting question. I mean, that's what filled the headlines, right? We got to decide if intelligent design is science. Not whether it's right or wrong, but is it science? And so the whole debate has been whether or not it's science. Well, I'd argue, wrong question. I don't care if it's science or not. I mean, what I care about is it true or not? Why do we care whether it's science or not? And what I would argue is we've seen a lot of this foundation all week, because science is our final authority of what's true in this culture. The scientific method tells us what's objectively and certainly true. So for the scientists, if they can just say, that's not science, they don't have to deal with it. And for the people on the intelligent design side, if we can't make this look like science and actually get the debate going in that arena, then we're never going to get anywhere here. I mean, that's what we need to do. We need to be credible in that arena. I don't think so, because as I pointed out the last few days, that whole view of science, that arena, that whole thing, it's a fallacious, they're standing on a really faulty, fallacious perspective. The whole arena is wrong. So it seems to me that I don't care if this is science or not. And the other thing I want to highlight is, even if we bought their argument about what science is, look at the judge's decision. One, well, this century-old ground rules of science says there isn't any design. Well, one, it's not centuries old. Science has really vacillated over time. I don't know what those rules are, and I've been at this stuff a while, but I don't have a clue what those rules are that they're referring to. If it's other than this rule of sciences testing hypotheses and that kind of stuff. But wait a minute, did Copernicus, Galileo, Newton, did any of those guys primarily test hypotheses? Doesn't seem like it to me. So anyway, my starting point is that's the wrong place to begin with this whole thing to start with. There's nothing to be gained by that conversation. What we need to talk about here is, what kind of a question is this? And what role does science really have an answer in this question. That's what we need to focus on. So let's look a little closer at the judge's ruling then with regard to this. First thing I want to say is, wow, we've got a judge making this decision for us? That's pretty strange. But it's not unprecedented because 4 or 5 years ago in, you know, the kind of field I work in, salmon recovery, the Oregon Cattlemen's Association put forth a proposed law defining science for the state of Oregon. Now, why would the Oregon Cattlemen's Association want to define science for the state? Well, I can guess. But that's become, I mean, that's where we are in deciding some of these issues. That's pretty scary. To me, that's pretty scary. Secondly, again, I've sort of done the critique of the judge said ID failed on three grounds. The first ground was it violated the centuries-old rules of science, this methodological naturalism. I say, I don't have a clue what those are. Secondly, he basically said it was a negative argument that if they could critique something in evolution, then that they were saying that that was positive for their theory. Well, the judge is right. That's not true. But I don't know any folk. I don't know anybody who's a proponent of ID that's actually made that argument. Maybe they have, but I'm not aware of it. The third argument he made was the scientific community has refuted all the problems that ID raised. And what you see in there is a whole bunch of statements by the National Academy of Science. Well, I have a problem with that, and here's my problem with that. It seems to me, if you look at the Copernican Revolution, that what it amounted to is Galileo is standing here, and in fact, it was proposed to him that a problem with you Copernican guys is you don't have a lot of followers. Nobody's believing you. I mean, we're the experts, and none of us think you're right. What did Galileo respond? It seems to me Galileo basically said the same thing Luther said to the church. Hey, ultimately, what's the authority? The individual's right through his own reason to look at it and decide what's true for himself. I mean, to me, that's the real step out of the Middle Ages. That it's now the role of the individual through their reason. And admittedly, we did some pretty weird things with reason since, but that was the ground upon which we're going to stand coming out of the Middle Ages. And what are they now saying? Well, the community of science says, to me, that's the new priesthood. There's the medieval Catholic Church. It's the same. Those are the folks now we're basically, you know, legislating what's truth for us because we don't know enough. These are tough questions that we have no basis making those kind of decisions on. Well, to me, this is a return to the Middle Ages, at least with regard to knowledge and the grounds of authority. Okay, I'm going to wrap this up here. And so at least a few of my bullets, and I need to give Peter some bullets here, I guess, before the end. So one of these I'll fold into mine. But the point I want to make is there's no split between faith and science. They're not different ways of knowing. In fact, Jack probably doesn't even remember this, but when the light bulb came on for me, I was in Jeet school. He had on the board sort of the rules of doing exegesis or the steps in doing exegesis. And I looked at that and I said, Jack, I mean, that looks like the scientific method that I've been looking for and figuring out how to formulate it. And Jack just looks at me and said, well, why do you think you'd be any different doing this from doing anything else? Well, why should I have? There is no reason. I should have thought there was any difference. Why did I think there was a difference? Because I really believed that science was on the knowledge side and this other stuff was on the opinion side or something less. That science really was a different way of knowing, and it had qualitatively more superior, that its knowledge was qualitatively more superior. That's not true. Secondly, we've talked about the fallacious view of science. I've talked a lot about that. My next point is Darwin's theory is not as proven as the proponents would like to have the culture believe it is. I mean, if it was, then we're out to lunch. I mean, if Darwin's theory really is true, then why are we looking for some other explanation? If it's true, I mean, I think intelligent design is a scientific theory, but I don't think that's a very interesting question. The question of whether it's true or not is much more interesting. And to answer that, it's going to take a lot more than science to answer that. And lastly, the judge's ruling was wide of the mark. I mean, I'm being kind. The judge's ruling was an expression of where our culture, of the literacy of our culture with regard to these kind of issues. That's disturbing. So anyway, I would hope that in the week that, you know, we've raised a number of these issues, and hopefully this has somehow helped you think about the questions of faith and science and how we ought to think about them. So I'll stop there.